Yeah, no, the top 100 is extensive, it's expansive, and on that note, we'll bring in Scott, who did publish this week his final top 100 a couple of weeks at the time when it went up on The Athletic before the draft. Thanks for joining us, Scott. I will start with sort of what Alex was talking about there, where no combine this year. I know, and as he just told that story there, that you're a guy who you're not just following the top five prospects, you are getting eyes on, you're getting insights on a ton of prospects from the top of the draft through basically the end of the draft. With the draft being in October, and I know that you did write a little bit about this at The Athletic, what was the biggest challenge for you not having some of the tournaments that were canceled, whether it's the Memorial Cup or some of the international tournaments, to prep for this year's draft?
Well, first of all, I just want to say thanks for the kind words off the top there. I appreciate that. As far as this draft goes, it was certainly a different process. I mean, there's no question it was sort of an upending of the way that I typically do my job. And the combine is typically sort of the bookend of my final list. My final list typically comes out either the week before or the week after the combine, depending on how I'm feeling about it. And that also means that I've typically already been to the Memorial Cup. I've already been to U18 Worlds. I had a trip to both of those tournaments planned this year before everything got shut down, not to mention things like the Frozen Four, et cetera, that were also canceled in that sort of same time range early on during COVID. So that definitely changed things. I've got the OHL right in my backyard, so missing out on the OHL playoffs was a bit of a bummer as well. But all told, I think what eventually happened is I was a little worried in the early days that maybe my list wasn't going to be as thorough as I would like it to be, or maybe I was going to be a little bit behind in terms of lacking some of the viewings down the stretch that I would have hoped to have gotten on a lot of these kids. But once the draft got pushed from sort of June, July, August into the fall here, it gave me the proper time to borderline make this list more thorough than any list I've ever put together. And this is my seventh year sort of covering the draft full time, if you will. But it's the first time where I've ever sort of released the list that I released this year and felt just so confident in again, not only those top guys that you guys kind of talked about, but also in the downboard, in the players a little bit further down, not only through viewings and that kind of thing that happened over the course of the summer on a much greater scale than it normally does, but just in the ability to call a coach, call a general manager, call their agent, speak to other scouts, and just kind of pick people's brains about these kids. So that if there was, hey, if my last list, someone pointed out to me that I should look at a kid skating or look at a certain asset that they think that I've undervalued, or if there's a player altogether that they felt that I should have had in a different kind of a range, then it gives me an opportunity to maybe not change my opinion on that kid, but go back and make sure that I'm really certain in terms of where I'm at on them before I sort of go ahead with my sort of quote unquote final hit list that you talked about there. So it's been different, no question, but I think it's been almost a blessing to have all of this extra time. And we're never going to have a draft class ever again where we have, instead of a year, but basically a year and a half, a year and 8 months here to really make sure that we're as dialed in as we possibly can be on these kids. And I think the same has happened with these NHL clubs. As much as NHL scouts and scouts in the private sphere want to be in the building, I think teams are feeling really good about their lists and where they're at this point, which is not what I expected when things canceled, when I had a little bit of that sort of initial panic of, oh my God, what comes next? So I think everybody's feeling good about it, and now it's go time here, and I can't wait to get going.
Scott Wheeler from The Athletic joining us on Sportsnet 650. Scott, the draft and the combine and the lead-up is always usually sort of tent-pulled with a few headliners. Sometimes there's multiple. This year, it's Alexis Lafreniere, and there's been a lot said of him. He spent 3 years in the queue with Rimouski. I don't want to go too in deep with Alexis, but I am curious to know, is there any chance the Rangers do not take him at number one?
No, I don't think that there is. I think that's all but locked in at this point. Alexi has established himself as the clear front runner for the last few years. I mean, he played that extra year in junior hockey. He's got 3 years in the queue under his belt. He's on the older side of this draft, so he's a year older than a player like Quinton Byfield, for example, who's likely to go second or third overall. So he's got the NHL readiness. He's got this sort of physique and the athleticism, and he's been able to build some strength. And this offseason has given him some extra time to heal a sort of ankle injury that nagged him throughout his entire draft year. So he's ready to go. He's going to step into the NHL right away. He's one of those kids who, despite this being a pretty top sort of top end of the draft, if you will. I really like 8 or 9 kids in this draft in a sort of top 5 kind of a way. And there's normally only 3 or 4 kids that I'm comfortable in that kind of a range in any given draft. So it's a very deep draft at the top, especially in terms of the forward. And he has still managed in that kind of a group to establish himself as the clear best player. And I think the big reason for that is that he doesn't have some of the holes that those other kids have. Tim Stützle has that amazing skating that we all know about, but he's got some other areas of his game, particularly defensively and a little bit in the offensive zone in terms of the way he navigates as well, that are quote-unquote holes. And then Quinton Byfield's on the younger side of this draft, and he's sort of in that same kind of a range in terms of projecting him, and you love the upside, but you're not sure about how it's all going to sort of fit together, if you will, at the next level. So with Alexi, there's none of that. He's bigger than everybody else. He's stronger than everyone else. He protects the puck better than everyone else. He's going to be able to be a rush player and a cycle player. He's going to be able to be a playmaker and a goal scorer. So there's nothing really in his game that sort of is going to hold him back. And short of being a sort of Austin Matthews level or a Connor McDavid level or a Jack Eichel level prospect, he's not quite at that tier, but he's in that very next tier of prospects where you're probably looking at him a cut above a Jack Hughes at the same age, and certainly a cut above the Nico Hischiers and the Nolan Patricks of the world at the same age. So he's going to be a legitimate star. I think he's going to be one of the top left wings in the NHL for a long time. And maybe he doesn't ever put up 100 points in his career, but I think he's still going to be that kind of franchise-altering player, and just a huge, huge day for a New York Rangers team that was already heading in the right direction.
One of the things that I noticed, Scott, when you're at the combine and you get a chance to spend some time with these kids, is a lot of them haven't faced sort of the media that they're facing now, and some of them mm-hmm. can not quite know how to handle it. Some of them seem to be really cool under pressure. I know two players that had really stood out for me during the last few years were Cale Makar and Quinn Hughes. They walked in, they sort of owned the room. They weren't cocky, but very, very confident and comfortable. I get the sense from your write-up that number 3 on your list, Marco Rossi, a centerman from the Ottawa 67s, may fit into that mold. He seems like a really interesting prospect. Just wondering if you could sort of talk a little bit about what you like about Marco.
Yeah, Marco is absolutely fascinating to me. I actually did a kind of immersive storytelling piece of journalism with him 2 years ago now, where I lived with him once he moved over here to play for the Ottawa 67s and spent a week with his dad and with his family and with his billets and just sort of doing everything that he did in a day for 4 or 5 days there. And in doing that, I got to know him and just sort of know what he's like. And back then, his English was a major, major barrier for him. And he had just come over from Austria. He was very limited. And he's worked really hard at that. And I think now what you're seeing when he does these interviews and when he talks to whether it's NHL clubs in terms of what I've heard about how those interview processes have gone, or in just the media, the top 8 prospects did media avails with the NHL media this week. And his English has come a long way. And with that has just come the kind of confidence that you're sort of hinting at in players like Quinn Hughes. And also, frankly, his brother Jack last year ahead of his draft class just had that sort of swagger and confidence about him. And the same has certainly developed in Marco Rossi. I would add that the same is absolutely true of Cole Perfetti, who's number 4 on my board. In 7 years of doing this, Cole Perfetti is the most articulate, well-spoken kid I've ever interacted with. And I think that's a real testament to both who he is off the ice and also the intelligence that he has on the ice. But Marco's the same way. Marco's just sort of cut a little bit differently. He approaches this a little bit differently than all of these other kids. And his focus is just singular. He wants to be the best that he can be. And we hear a lot about that, and it can become a little bit of a cliche with these top prospects. They all have that kind of work ethic that everybody hears about. But Marco's takes that even a step further. And I think now that he's comfortable with the language, it's showing in terms of the way that he carries himself as well. He knows who he is. He knows where he wants to be. And I really do think he's going to get there. So Marco is a really, really special kid off the ice. And then on the ice, I think he's the most versatile player in this draft class, to be quite honest, even including Alexi Lafreniere. I think he is the best defensive forward in this draft. I think he's going to be able to be trusted in D-zone situations, on the penalty kill, late game, on sort of tough face-offs. He's a dominant, dominant face-off player. And all of those things, despite the fact that I think he's a little bit lower end in terms of his offensive quality, maybe, relative to a Cole Perfetti or a Lucas Raymond or a Quinton Byfield or a Tim Stützle, I think he's a cut above those players on the defensive side of the puck, just his awareness when he doesn't have it, and the way that he works so efficiently to sort of get it back and to win back possession, and then to escape those sort of battles with possession and all of the skill that he does have. So he's a special kid, and I don't think you're going to see the kind of counting stats out of him that you might see out of some of those other kids, but I still think he has a good chance to be one of the best players in the draft because of everything else that he brings. So I can't wait to see what he does with it. He's the only kid out of Europe this year that hasn't signed in Europe, so he's basically sent the message to these NHL clubs that I'm going to make the team. I'm going to wait out. I'm going to sit. I may not be playing hockey as early as a lot of my peers are, but once NHL training camps start, I'm going to be the fittest guy in all of the training that we do. I'm going to show off in some of the sort of physicality, athletic drills that they put the prospects through early on. And then I'm going to make my NHL club as probably one of only two or three kids out of this draft that's going to make the NHL in his first year. So can't wait to get back. And once that sort of new season starts up in December or January here, to see which NHL club he's with and what kind of impact he can have right away.
Scott Wheeler joins us on air, Sportsnet 650. You can follow his draft work and a bunch of other stuff that he does for The Athletic as well. A couple things on the draft in general and this draft specifically. There was a lot of talk, I think, probably coming off of last year's draft and then through the fall, that this was a, quote, deep draft. I'm wondering what your definition it is for what that means. Our colleague at The Athletic, Sanaya Saperji, did her annual scouts poll, and there seems to be a lot of variance between even each individual scout as to how they evaluate that. Is it top end depth? Is it ability to get an impact player in the second round, et cetera, et cetera? And where do you stand on the depth of this draft? Because it does seem like in recent months that that's been walked back a little bit, that it's maybe not quite as deep of a draft class as earlier anticipated.
Yeah, I think you have to look at the depth of a draft class in two ways. You have to look at that kind of top 10 that I talked about. How many kids have the chance to be legitimately in the top 5 or 6 conversation? Normally, as I said, it's normally only 3, 4, maybe 5 kids for me in a draft. So the fact that there's 8 or 9 in this draft suggests that at least at the top, where the drafts are really defined, is by their star players and the number of kids who go on to become sort of top of the lineup players in the NHL. So I think in that way, at the top of the draft, it's certainly a deep draft. And then in the second way, I think it's how many kids could realistically sort of deserve to go in the first round. And sometimes they're in a 31, soon to be 32 team league. Sometimes there aren't even 31 or 32 kids that I'm comfortable saying in that. In this year, there was a real drop off on my board around pick 38 or 39 on my board. So that suggests that there's sort of a few kids at the very least who are going to go in that second round who are probably first round talents for me in any given draft. And that again says that, to me at least, that this is a deeper draft than is typical. I'm not sure it's the deepest draft in the world. This is not 2015. I believe that 2015 is going to go down in history as a better draft than 2003 and could go down in history as the best draft we've ever had in 100 plus years of doing this now. So 2015 was special, but I think in the draft since then, 2016 to 2019, I would qualify pretty much all of those drafts as about average, maybe 2017's a cut below average. And I think this is an above average draft in terms of that depth that you're talking about. So I don't think it's a historic draft per se, especially because it lacks that sort of Austin Matthews, Connor McDavid, Jack Eichel type that I talked about. But I think in terms of the depth in numbers, you've got 38, 39 sort of first round prospects for me. And that qualifies this draft, I think, as pretty deep.
Scott, you touched on 2015. And one of the notable things that happened in that first round was the Boston Bruins had 3 consecutive picks, mm-hmm. Sort of in the teens. And now that we look at that 5 years later, it's, wouldn't say consensus, but there's a large feeling that they missed on at least 2, if not 3 of those picks. As we look to this year, the Ottawa Senators, they have 3 picks. They've got 2 in the top 5, and then they've got 1 in the late first round. Just wondering what you see. They also bought out Bobby Ryan this week. I'm just curious to know what you think the advantage is with Ottawa, maybe how they could position themselves this year at the draft, whether you think they keep all 3 picks, and if there's anyone you specifically like for Ottawa at any of those picks.
Well, I think that this is a huge, huge opportunity for the history of the Senators organization. They have a chance to really change the makeup of of where the next 5 or 10 years goes for them with this draft. And so I think it's incumbent on them to really swing for the fences, really try to make impact on those kids, and don't be shy to swing on talent. I've said that all along, and try not to. If I was sitting at that table, my argument would be try not to sort of box yourself into the typical problem that happens with a lot of teams that have 2 or 3 high picks in a draft, where suddenly you're convincing yourself that you have to take a forward and a defenseman with one of those picks, or that you have to take a goalie with the third pick, or that kind of a sort of mentality can creep in when you've already got someone at a position that you felt you needed, and suddenly you think, okay, we need to create balance for the sake of balance here, so that these kids all have a sort of direction to move into, and they aren't fighting each other for opportunities and that kind of a thing. My argument with this draft, especially with that pick at 3 and 5, would be take 2 forwards. I think taking Jamie Drysdale and Jake Sanderson, who are the consensus top 2 defensemen in this draft, relative to some of those forwards, would be a mistake. I think it's a mistake on talent in terms of those forwards just being better prospects. But I also think even on need, the argument isn't there, because at the NHL level, the Ottawa Senators have Thomas Chabot. They've got Eric Brandstrom coming. They've got Lassie Thompson coming. They've got Jacob Bernard Docker coming. They have serious depth on defense that's coming. And as good as Brady Tkachuk and Drake Batherson and Shane Pinto and all of those sort of kids that are coming up front as well are, I would say that it's a deep pool of prospects up front for Ottawa, but that Brady Tkachuk isn't going to be a number one or a number two player on a Stanley Cup winning team, and neither is Drake Batherson. So I think that this draft is a very forward-heavy draft at the top, and as much as I understand the temptation to go with 1 forward and 1 defenseman with those 3 and 5 picks, I'm probably picking certainly Quinton Byfield if he's available at number 3, and then I'm probably looking at players like Cole Perfetti and Lucas Raymond to take a real home run swing at number 5 and try to connect with another sort of first line forward prospect. So that would be my approach with those 2 picks. And then the pick that's a little bit later is harder to handicap, I think, just because you don't know who's going to be available. But again, I would probably be tempted, based off of who's likely to be available there, to go forward for a third time, even just because after those 2 defensemen that I talked about, it does tail off in this draft. You're probably going to have a couple of defensemen that go in the teens that maybe shouldn't go there. And then suddenly you're going to have players who are in the top 15 on my board who are available in the sort of late teens or early 20s or even late 20s in this draft, who are forward prospects with serious sort of top 6 upside, if you will. So I would probably just swing on talent with all 3 of those picks and not pay a ton of attention to the defensemen that are available, unless there's a defenseman that falls. But again, I don't think that that's going to happen in this draft. We always see 4 or 5 defensemen go in the top 15, and I really only have 2 ranked there. So suddenly if 4 or 5 defensemen are going to go in that range, which almost happens every year, then there's going to be some darn good forwards that fall. And you could see something like what happened last year with players like a Cole Caulfield and a Peyton Krebs and an Alex Newhook, who fell into those sort of late teens when they probably belonged closer to the top 10. So that would be my sort of advice if I'm sitting at the scouting table with the Senators, but we'll see which way they go for it. I know that they like both of those defensemen, so I think there is a good chance that they go forward at 3 and defensemen at 5.
Well, we'll get you out of here on this, Scott. No Canucks hockey to watch in the fall, so I think a lot of eyes are going to be on the top 2 prospects who are already playing in Europe. Vasily Podkolzin in the KHL, Niels Höglander in Sweden. Where do you stand right now with those 2 guys and what they might look like in the NHL?
Well, I've always been a little bit lower on one and a little bit higher on the other than the sort of quote-unquote consensus, if you will. So I've always been a little bit lower on Podkolzin. I think he's got a fabulous skill set. Certainly he's built like an NHL player. He can get to the front of the net. He's got great hands. The sort of singular skills that you look for in a prospect, they're all there with Podkolzin. Sometimes I worry that he gets a little bit too wound up and that he needs to sort of downshift a gear, if you will, and sort of relax out there and make the sort of delayed play rather than the play that's directly in front of him, because I think he can just get a little bit caught up in what's happening on the ice, and at NHL pace that may become an even bigger problem for him. So that's my one concern if I have one with Podkolzin. He should be playing more in the KHL than he is, so I think that's a factor in terms of some of the production and that kind of a thing. I think he's a better prospect than the numbers show, for sure. And then with Höglander, I'm a big, big fan. He's going to be a fan favorite. He's feisty, despite being a little bit on the smaller side. He's sort of always in the mix. He's always involved when he's on the ice. And then he's got this unique puck skill that allows him to be very elusive once he gets it. So he's a little sort of out there and very noticeable when he doesn't have the puck, because he's constantly chasing and finishing his checks and being a kind of prick when he's out there. And then when he does have the puck, he's a little bit of a different player. He's elusive. He's crafty. He's creative. There's some ingenuity to his game in terms of the way that he navigates the offensive zone and the way that he spins and stops and starts. He's a really good player at changing direction. So he's a fabulous sort of complimentary winger, I think. I think you're looking at Höglander as a player who's going to be able to play on the power play and then also maybe potentially drive a middle six line as a sort of primary carrier and that kind of a thing. So I'm actually a little bit higher on Höglander, I think, than I am on Podkolzin at this point. It's close. I think that could go either way, but I think both will be NHLers. I don't think either are going to be stars, but I think you're looking at two contributors who can kind of give you a little bit everything and have some physical edge to both of them, quite frankly. So that part of it, I think, is exciting, and I think they'll endear themselves to the Canucks fan base for sure.
Scott, no, this is a busy time of year for you, so thanks for taking the time to talk with us, and enjoy the draft next week, all right? Or in a couple weeks, all right?
I can't wait. Thanks for having me, guys.